Oh, and I did not know Ottawa's main export is lumberjacks. That's
Hello and welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show. Our guest for this episode is Jonathan Snook, product manager at Shopify.com. You can find Jonathan on Twitter at SnookCA, and he blogs at Snook.ca, just like every good Canadian should. In this episode, Jonathan talks about his entry to the web, his start in computer retail sales, working on government websites, personal projects, writing a blog, writing a book, designing products at Yahoo, and the story behind Jack the Lumberjack. And of course, we have a lot of smack talk. Your hosts for this episode are Sam Kaff and Christopher Schmidt. Christopher and the Environments for Humans crew are prepping for an awesome second annual CSS DevConf, October 21st to 23rd in the 2013s. Speakers include Jonathan Snook, that's what they call brand synergy, folks, Chris Coyer, Nicole Sullivan, and so many more. I'm still waiting for my invitation to speak on Front Page 98 and CSS 3, but I'm sure Christopher has a big announcement coming soon. So check out cssdevconf.com on the interweb for full details and how to buy tickets and plan to attend. Sam Kaff is a design educator and designer in Austin, Texas, and she's also the co-host of the ATX Web Show podcast for the Austin web community, available at atxwebshow.com. Of course, all this stuff and more is available at nonbreakingspace.tv. This is the point in the introduction where I'm supposed to ask you to leave a rating or review in the iTunes podcast listing, but I know you've already done that, all of you, so there's no point in pausing the show, loading up iTunes, looking for Non-Breaking Space in the store, and leaving a five-star review with words such as Christopher is great, the introduction guy is hilarious, Sam Kaff is awesome, those kind of things. You've already done that, so there's no point in asking you, so we'll skip that part for this episode. On with the show, and please enjoy it responsibly.
Yeah, and we're recording already, so we've been recording. So we just dive into it now. So, we're honored that you're on the show and you had time to talk to us today. And you know, the first thing that we do is just ask how you got into the industry and what path you got there. Because you know, everyone in our generation, there is no like, you know, you go to school for this and then you graduate and then you're a web designer and stuff like that. So I'm always interested in how people got into the web.
Yeah, it definitely was. There was no school. There was no like monumental moment where things suddenly flipped per se. But there kind of was. So going back to way back when, before 94, I spent a lot of my online time with bulletin boards, which was awesome. Like I could hop online, you know, leave messages, and then we had a local. I'm trying to think of the name of the group, Freenet. And within the Freenet, they actually had a chat room that originally was only open after 11 p.m. And so you can imagine the type of people that would be online after 11 p.m. at night. And then they opened it up even more. So it was open 24 hours. And that was my first real sort of like being able to connect with people one-on-one and have these kind of conversations with these people around the world. And then the web came out, and for me it was like, this is awesome, you know, having played with Gopher and realizing just how useless Gopher was. The web was this really fun place, much more visual, felt like in a weird way things were easier to find. And I think, you know, that just the hyperlinking of stuff was a lot easier than Gopher, where you were like using an Archie client to try to find text on a server, and yeah, it was a lot more fun to play with.
That's kind of cool, because like I actually started out with a Freenet too. I came from Tallahassee Freenet.
Okay,
and,
cool.
Yeah, and then I was doing the Gopher, doing the Archie and stuff like that, and just trying to get around. I never got into BBSs. I did try BBSs a few times. I downloaded the like Atlanta Olympics logo off of BBS one time. I was like, okay, that's great. But and so I was trying all these new things, and then someone told me like, hey, have you tried the web with Mosaic? And I was like, oh man, another thing.
So very interesting that, you know, that the parallels in our career, I guess. So for me, the idea of the web was just it was an extension of what everything was before that, which was a hobby. So, you know, from like 94 to 98, I really saw this web as just it was a hobby, something to play with. And I built my own websites, you know, just things that had interested me. And it was in 98 where that switch flipped. I was working at a computer store selling software and hardware, retail really, and realizing that, you know what, there are a ton of people that are actually making web development a career. Mm-hmm. I could really probably do this as a career. And I actually went in one day, told my boss, you know what, next week I'm not coming into work. And
what were you working, like what was your job?
I was just like a salesperson. I was you know, selling stuff.
What were you selling?
Windows computers, okay. Software, just like retail software.
Okay. So you're still like, you're doing computer stuff, but you basically you wanted like to build web stuff. Like you want a web job, right?
Yeah. Because working at the computer store was retail, which was an extension of what I was doing before that, which was working at Toys R Us, which was, you know, before that working in a movie theater as a theater usher. So like nothing really long term. I'm going to build a career out of this. I'm not going to build a career out of being a salesperson. And yet with the web, I actually hit that point finally in 98 and thought, you know what? Yes, I can actually build a career out of this. This is something that I enjoy doing. I think there's a lot of potential in this. Things I think are only going to continue to go up.
Did anyone think you were crazy to get a web job?
No, not at all.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Most of my friends were pretty geeky as well. So,
okay.
You know, they were developers and programmers, but like programmers, so they were more on the sort of computer science side of things. Whereas I was never maybe quite that driven for that kind of thing. Right. I was pretty aimless for my early 20s. Didn't really know what I wanted to do until I sort of had this light bulb moment to get into the web.
Right. Well, I say that because like now you say like, hey, why do you want to get in the web? It's kind of crazy. Like people are like, you know, going to the web. People are going to, you know, college to learn about the web design and development and so that. But back in the 90s, like, you know, in this era, you know, it wasn't like a sure thing, right? That it was going to be around. People just didn't know what it was, you know, what was going on. And then I'm not sure if it was about this time or not, but like Heaven's Gate happened and their job, like it was a cult or whatever. And they committed mass suicide and their job by day was web design. And so my relatives were like, so what do you do, Chris? Like, oh, man.
I promise I'm not going to commit suicide.
Or join a cult. That's
yes. Okay. Yeah, that would be good.
Okay.
Cool. Because all web designers are part of this cult, aren't we?
Yeah. So you went in for an interview for a job. What job was it? Where were you in?
It was an agency here in Ottawa. Really small place, dealing primarily with government clients, Ottawa being the nation's capital, kind of similar to Washington, D.C. in the sense that there's a lot of government here. And so I had an interview with this agency, said, you know, I'd love to work with you guys. Turned out that they had a one-week contract available because they were trying to finish up this project. They just needed a bunch of people to create a bunch of HTML and CSS, or actually not even CSS. CSS wasn't really being used that much. So it was primarily just HTML. You know, we need to build a static site. Databases weren't really something that company was using a lot of. A lot of the sites that we were building were like 1,000 pages of static content. I came in and just tried to do as great a job as I could within that week. Thankfully, they thought it was pretty awesome and they hired me full time.
Oh, awesome. Cool. And then what type of projects were you working on like after that?
A lot more government. Yeah, it's I ended up working there for about 2 years, and the 2 years that I worked there were probably 95% government, and a lot of my role shifted over that 2 years. I started off as what was called a technical architect, which meant that I was designing the way applications should work. So, you know, they need or, you know, how a site should be organized. And so taking these user flows and, you know, how are people going to actually use the stuff that we were building, and do a, create a lot of documentation around that. And then we had developers that would actually build that stuff out. Then I had shifted into project management, so having a team of people and still really kind of managing the flow of that project. But I was realizing that what I really enjoyed was more of the hands-on stuff.
Right.
And near the end, really kind of shifted my role, trying to do a lot more development, even though I was in a project management role, taking projects on the side to improve my development. And back then, we were getting more into MySQL, sorry, not MySQL, SQL Server development, Microsoft SQL Server, and ASP development. So I'm really kind of focusing on Microsoft technologies. And then a little bit of Cold Fusion.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah, which I was fun. We actually had a great Cold Fusion developer, and it was great to learn a lot of cool tricks from him.
So what? So you were a developer, then you transitioned to project management. How was that transition for you?
Actually, it was more going from project management to developer, which is kind of weird. Like I had a good sense of how things should be built, but maybe not the technical depth, not having the history to know how to develop things well. And so I definitely picked up a lot of stuff from my coworkers at the time to expand my technical knowledge. So that I could actually do a lot of the development myself, just because I felt that's what I enjoyed the most.
Cool. Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering if you had like a, you know, like not everyone who's a developer can be a great project manager and vice versa. It's really rare that someone is like just awesome at being both a developer and a project manager. I found.
It's interesting how my career has actually kind of come full circle in a way.
Yeah.
I think so. My role now. After all these years and all the different companies that I've worked for since then, I'm now working at Shopify, and I'm now a product manager, not project manager. So I'm not really dealing with people per se and saying, you need to work on this, you need to work on that.
Right.
But as a product manager, sort of defining, you know, what's the technical direction or the design direction, you know, the product direction. What direction are we heading in? What features do we need to have? How are people going to use this stuff? And then being able to work with really talented designers and developers to make that vision happen. So it's, in a way, very similar to what I started out doing.
Cool. So, and I know that's kind of fascinating. I never really, I guess I never met someone who was a product manager before. So is it, what type of things do you do handle like day to day at Shopify is there a part of Shopify that you're in charge of, or are you just charge of like what product specifically I'm talking about, and like what type of day to day stuff do you handle?
Yeah. So I'm the core product manager, and the core is the admin tool that all the store owners use to manage their store. And so we have a number of different products. We actually just launched Shopify Payments. So we have a payments team that manages that one. We have an app store. So we have a product manager for that. We have a theme store. We have a product manager for that. And so all these different areas have product managers that can manage the direction and whatnot for that. And so for the admin, my role is to do a lot of research. So I look at a lot of data. I talk to a lot of customers. I talk to our support staff. We have a user experience team, so I can rely on them to do a lot of research for us. We have a data team, so I can talk to them about looking at numbers, pull me out stats, figure out, you know, what are people using, what are they not using, what do they want to be able to do. And then be able to prioritize that stuff. What's the most important thing that we need to build right now that is going to have the biggest impact, not only on our current users, but all the new users that we want to have using Shopify?
Yeah, awesome. Cool. Awesome. So I know we jumped around because you were at you were a project manager at the Ottawa agency and stuff like that. So where'd you go from Ottawa agency to Shopify? Like, what was the...
What happened in between, right? Let's fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
Well, we started off, so i4design was the little agency that I worked for, and there became this sort of tipping point where they were starting to lose a number of people, and some friends of mine ended up going to this other company in town that was really looking to establish. They were a print house and looking to establish their web presence. And it was an opportunity for me to jump in and help grow that and really put it in a direction that I thought, you know, we should be going in. So I went to work for this company called H3 Creative, which it's interesting from a naming perspective. I for design was letter I, number 4, design. And then I jumped to a company called letter H, number 3, creative. Yeah, the naming was maybe a little too similar. But that really kind of the same type of thing that I was doing, but sort of managing what is the technical direction. But because I was like the first real web person that they had, I was trying to do everything. And, you know, we got to grow our team a little bit, 2, 3, 4 different people on the website, trying to focus on this stuff as the company really wanted to be this sort of full service company doing both print and web design. Unfortunately, things never really took off for that. And then I moved off to another company also in town.
Was it O24 Bingo?
You would think, you know, you were getting pretty close. The company I ended up switching off to was Fuel Industries.
Oh, okay.
Now, Fuel Industries, it's interesting as a name. I go, yeah, I'm going to work for Fuel Industries. And people were like, my family and friends were like, oh, you're getting into the gas business? Is that how that works? So I had to explain. Fuel Industries was a web design company in Ottawa, but doing some really awesome work with companies around the world. They had campaigns with Apple and Red Bull and just really great clients. And this was the first company that I got a chance to work for that I would work on a project that people had heard about. We had done a website for The Family Guy. And it was like, oh yeah, I've seen that. I've used it. I played with it. It was a lot of fun. And it's like, I got to build that. It was a lot different than working on government websites, which aren't very exciting. In fact, I remember working on a project that was a CD-ROM about salt.
Nice.
You can imagine how exciting. And it was like the static HTML content. You pop in the CD, it opens up your web browser, and you get to browse this website about salt. So to go from that and all these lovely government projects to...
Well, salt is important. I'm not going to like...
Oh, it is.
Slack off on salt, all right?
Iodized salt is very important. I learned all about iodized salt. This is very important stuff, but not really all that exciting when you talk to your friends and family about it. So working for Fuel Industries is that I had that opportunity. And the talent that they had brought into that company was amazing. They had built an entire video studio with green screen so they could do video production. They had built a soundproof studio to do sound production so they could do all their own sound production. They had classic animators with like whiteboards and being able to do storyboards and whatnot for their projects. They had Flash designers, Flash developers, Shockwave developers to do game design. Had 3D animators, 3D texturers. Just the amount of talent they brought into one company was incredible. Like most companies try to specialize on like one thing. But the fact that they had all this talent in one place in Ottawa, and that I got to be involved in that and involved in the projects that we were building on, it was a lot of fun.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think what really was really harder for my career is like, the web thing is booming. People are interested. There's agencies that just do websites. But it was that, like what you're talking about is like really awesome is that, you know, they bring you in, but there's all these different industries, different talents, different creatives from animation and stuff like that. And you're all kind of like working together. And it's not like the web is subservient, you know, to the others. So that's pretty awesome that you worked at such.
And getting to see the bigger picture too of whatever it is that you're working on, whether it's Apple or Salt or Red Bull, whatever it is, getting to see the different sides or the different pieces that come together just makes your job not easier to do, but I guess better informed.
Yeah, I think one of the things that going through a lot of these different jobs was just the exposure to a lot of variety. Andy Rutledge talks a lot about apprenticeship, and I feel like that is a very important thing. A lot of people get into web development because they think, you know what, I can be independent, I can freelance, I can work from home. But if people are coming out of school without any business background, I think they're doing themselves and their clients a disservice. I think that having that kind of hands-on experience with variety, agencies are a great way to get that variety. I mean, it exposed me to a lot of different processes, to a lot of the business side as well as the development side. It exposed me to a great, you know, just a number of talented people that I got to work with over the years. And I think that was hugely beneficial.
Yeah, I think it's definitely important, like, just to definitely get, you know, get different people's feedback and work with different smarter people.
Yes.
I mean, just when you're starting out, just realize, like, everyone's smarter than you. And they will still be as you get older, too. So
I think there's a good quote by, I want to say it's by Lorne Michaels from NBC, that if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And I think that applies a lot for web.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been really lucky to have worked with a lot of really smart people over the years.
Yeah. I think what is it, the same joke is like, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're there in a room full of idiots. I guess. but no, maybe that's a little. I have to go dig that one up. I know I heard that one somewhere before. But so you're working for this agency that had like different disciplines and everything.
Yes.
So how long did you stay there? Like, what was the most exciting thing that you worked on?
I mean, I was there for about a year and a half. And this is, now we're looking at about 2003, 2004. Mm-hmm. And this is when, like, I had started blogging for a couple of years. Blogging as a community had really started to blossom. And I was starting to get this opportunity to really put myself out there, to start to get to know a lot of people in the industry outside of Ottawa, and outside of this company that I had been working for.
Is that because of blogging itself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there was a little bit of starting to write for other sites, you know, looking at Digital Web, which is no longer with us, but is still up around. You can go to Digital Web. And so doing some of that writing, you know, trying to write for A List Apart, starting to write for magazines, and really just trying to get my name out there a little bit more, establish a little bit more of a personal identity and brand outside of the company that I was working for.
So before you get, like, what was the start or need for you to do that, to start blogging and get your word out, or get your brand out, or get yourself out there?
There was definitely this environment of sharing that just really seemed to be a part of our industry. Mm-hmm. I just realized that was really loud.
Your phone chimes in. I agree.
Exactly.
Well, like, yeah, I definitely agree that, like, you know, our industry is very unique in that we actually share stuff. Mm-hmm. I was actually at some agency yesterday, and I asked them some technology question, and I was expecting an answer. And other than the one I got was like, oh, it's secret. I was like, what? I could, you know, we can go find out what the solution is. You can just tell me what the technology is. It's pretty easy to go find this out. It's not a secret. We can just, you know, Google this stuff out. I mean, I don't really need to, like, but anyway. But yeah, so like other industries are just, you know, they don't have that sharing mentality that we have. And that I think that we need, right?
It's, yeah. I mean, our industry is changing so rapidly, and I think it is changing rapidly in part because of everybody sharing. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody can build on top of the ideas that other people are having, and that, you know, I think we're making everybody better as a result.
Right. And I say this on every other show, I think, but like GitHub is just blows my brain away because, I mean, there's been like, other, like in Google, there's Google Code and so on. There's other been other things like GitHub before, but they have a place where people like know, like, hey, I'm going to store my code here, and if you want to share it, I'll make it public. And you know, if you want to make it better, you know, it's easy to do on here, and it's, you know, that's mostly for coders, but it's also, there's some, you know, design stuff in there too as well. So, but there's just one aspect of it. But yeah, I think definitely our industry just just feeds off of the sharing, and it's there's no stopping it. I don't think there's any way you could if you were trying to. So, but yeah. Cool.
Yeah, so I mean, there was definitely some of it might have been a little ego driven, you know, that I wanted to be able to push my my identity out there and I don't know, get a little bit of notoriety. I think, you know, as bad as that sounds, I think nobody necessarily goes out of their way for that. But yeah, it was something that I felt like trying to do. Uh-huh.
At that point, were you thinking about writing a book yet, or did that come just naturally later down the road?
It came a little bit later. So I had ended up jumping into freelance. I'm just trying to think what year it was that I ended up jumping into freelance. Around 2004, I think I finally made the jump to freelance. And you know, now at this point, okay, I'm working on my own things. I'm establishing my own identity. And then, okay, you know what, I'm going to start going to conferences. And it was that moment that I started doing that. I ended up running into an editor, from, a book publisher. And, you know, when you talk to somebody, you know, and having done a little bit of writing elsewhere, sort of that idea of writing a book sounds kind of cool. And seeing people I know write books sounds kind of cool, but I hadn't made any effort towards actually writing a book. But then running into an editor, and editors are like, you know, if they've got topics, they need writers, they need somebody to be able to put this stuff together. It was a very easy thing for them to go, hey, you know, would you like to write a book? And I said, well, yes, I think I would. And that, you know, that snowball effect, okay, you know what, I will write a book. Mm-hmm.
And now there's what, 3-4 books?
3 books, yeah. There's the first one was nice and easy because it was only one chapter in the SitePoint book, The Art and Science of CSS. So that was fairly straightforward.
One chapter books are easy, man.
Nice. Yeah, I get to dip my toes into it a little bit. And then I took the big leap to say, you know what, I'm going to write an entire book. Working with A-Press to write this book about JavaScript, geared not so much at, like, not about jQuery, not about Prototype and all the sort of popular libraries at the time, but really to sort of provide some background to say that, you know what, plain old vanilla JavaScript is important. You need to understand these things. But talking about them in the context of libraries and how they're solving these problems so that people, when they did go to use the library, understood the background behind it, because I think it's important to understand the platform that you're building on. Mm-hmm. And it turned out writing a book is hard. It is so hard, especially a JavaScript book or any technical book where there's a lot of research that needs to be done. And that was the thing that I had completely underestimated, the amount of research involved. So like if I'm writing these 5 lines of code, is this the best way to write these 5 lines of code? Is this 5 lines of code, you know, cross-browser compatible? I have to test this. I have to, you know, research. Why is this the best way to do this? And as a result, you know, there was a lot of work required just to write a couple chapters of text around these examples that I was writing about. It got exhausting. I mean, it strung on way too long. And, you know, as publishers tend to do when things take a while, they want to finish up the book. So they were nice enough to find a few people to help out. So I managed to write 2/3 of the book. I wrote 6 chapters, and then they had gotten Dan Webb. They had gotten Aaron Gustafson. And I'm going to feel bad for having forgotten the third person that they ended up getting. I feel bad now.
I think I was just looking at it too, and I forgot his name too. Sorry, but yeah, it was Aaron and Dan, and I forgot the other person. Oh man, I was just looking at it. Let's see, this is important. We look it up.
Stuart Langridge. Yes.
Yeah. Sam's on the case.
You know what, Stuart? I hope Stuart doesn't listen to the podcast. sorry, Stuart.
A lot of people don't, so don't worry about it. That's all right.
But like 3 very talented people. you know, that can and should be writing books and have written books in their own right. So I was really happy that I was able to get these great people to help out with the book, finish it off, and put it out there. And after doing that, I thought, I will never write another book ever again.
I thought that 8 times in the past as well, you know that.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I mean, there were certainly a couple of times where, you know, I thought, okay, you know what, I'll try this. And I had gotten like a chapter into a new book. And then again, it's just life got in the way. And I said, you know what, screw it. I can't do this. I'm going to stop. Mm-hmm. And so I never ended up getting anywhere close to finishing another book for a long time. Which seems to lead in for the last one.
Well, what year was the A-Press book, which is called Accelerated DOM Scripting with Ajax APIs and Libraries.
So yes.
Got a lot of good words in there. So
of course. Search engine optimization is just as important for book publishers.
Exactly. So what year was that? I should probably know.
2007. That was 2007. That's 6 years ago now.
Wow. Okay. 2007. And then... So where were you working? You were still freelancing at that time?
Yes, freelancing at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great to have a book on the shelves. Like, it's awesome to be able to walk into a bookstore mm-hmm. and see your book there. Okay. I was really proud of having made that accomplishment. I've hit that milestone. You know, I've checked something off the bucket list.
Right.
Fantastic. And so I was happy. I didn't necessarily feel like I had to do it again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt like it would be nice to write more books, but I never felt like I must do this, that I had to get it done. And so I continued freelancing. I worked freelance until 2000, I'm trying to think what year it was, 2010,
mm-hmm.
2009.
Okay.
Time flies.
Yes.
I want to say it was the end of 2009 that I ended up getting a job at Yahoo.
Yeah.
So this is where I think my career ends up taking a maybe not a huge turn from a professional perspective, in the sense that I was still doing web development, still very technical with a little bit of design, aesthetic, you know, being able to understand sort of the how users should be or could be using an application, and really starting to I think feel fairly confident in the way I approached web development. And then coming into Yahoo and realizing just the scale that they work at, both with the number of users that they have, the size of the teams that they have, and just how we approach web development was a lot different than I thought it was going to need to be. I felt like, oh yeah, you know, how hard is it to build a website? I've written books about it. I've blogged about it. I've read blogs about it. There are things that you deal with when you are at that kind of scale where you realize, you know what, the way I was approaching things maybe wasn't the best way. It was a great learning experience. Again, just working with some really smart people and working on we worked on Yahoo Mail, Messenger, Calendar. So it wasn't just like one little project. It was multiple products, working with a team of 30 designers, worked with over 200 engineers, and being able to marry those two well. I worked on the prototyping team, but we didn't really do prototyping in the sense that what we built was thrown away. We actually acted more as a bridge between design and development. Again, I think my career history prepared me well for that role. Mm-hmm. Having had a lot of design work, especially as a freelancer, I did a fair amount of design work that I really enjoyed and that I was very proud of, and a lot of the agency work where I did a lot of back-end development, and being able to pull that together in that kind of role where I had to marry the two and make sure that, you know, the stuff that was being designed could be developed well, that it was usable, that, you know, we weren't reinventing the wheel in some places, and that we were building something that was fast, you know, really performant, and easy to maintain. I mean, if you got to think of, you know, we're building the front end for all these different products, how do we do that in a way that's easy to maintain? And So I worked there for 2 years, and about a year in, all the stuff that I had learned, I really started to think about my process and think about the process that we were using at Yahoo, and starting to formulate an actual approach to site development that was maybe a little bit more thoughtful than the approach that I had taken before. And with that, I decided to write another book, but a little bit differently this time. I didn't go to a publisher with the idea. I just wanted to start writing it out. I wanted to get as far as I could with that before I thought about doing anything with it. And after about 6 months of trying to put these thoughts together, I actually kind of got frustrated with that writing process, as one tends to do. And I put out what I had. I was like, listen, I'm not getting this book together quite in the way that I wanted to, so yeah. I'm just going to put it out there. Mm-hmm. Let me know what you guys think.
Yeah, I remember when you did that, and I was like, oh, so just posted like words fail me on a podcast. That's audio only. So basically, yeah, you just put this whole this manuscript out there about CSS, and I like immediately went to it, and I was like, holy cow, this is awesome. So, but I do, before we get to what that book is about and everything like that, but I just want to talk about a little bit about the job at Yahoo.
Yes.
A little bit. So if I understand this correctly, it's kind of like my visual of it is that you were on a team that's kind of roving and went from like other departments to other departments and basically helped them, build better designs, sort of. Code, is that it, or is that wrong?
Not quite. Yeah. What ended up happening is that they consolidated the design team, mm-hmm. around the entire communication suite. So that meant that they had a single design team, mm-hmm. building out the look and feel of all these products. So the Mail, Messenger, Calendar, mm-hmm. Address Book, and a bunch of other little apps. So that they all had a consistent design and approach. They also worked on the mobile apps, the iPad app. So now we have this very consistent design. Mm-hmm. Well, historically what they had done is they would take a design and they'd throw it over the wall to a particular engineering team, mm-hmm. and come back 2, 3, 4 months later and say, okay, we're done. And the designers would go, okay, that wasn't quite what I wanted. And the way that one department solved the problem was a little bit different than the way another department solved the problem.
Right.
And as a result, you had interactions that were inconsistent across products.
Right.
And as a result of this, we had decided to build a single HTML and CSS code base that would be, and even some JavaScript as well, that would be shared across all these teams. So we were an extension of the design team that worked in conjunction with the different engineering teams to make sure that the front end interactions that we were building were consistent across all those teams.
Oh, cool. And so you weren't like roving, you're more like you were the central part and people came to you,
yes.
to go through to produce their products. Okay, cool. Awesome.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome.
And it was a process that I thought worked well. I thought that, like I said, I was very happy with the kind of work that we were building, work with smart people. Mm-hmm. I think considering most of the people I know use Gmail, mm-hmm. To work for Yahoo and to work on their mail product and work on the problems that we were trying to solve. One, we needed it to be fast. So how fast could we make things load? Mm-hmm. How small could we make things? But then just, how usable was this application? Mm-hmm. How well could people interact with it? And, there was a lot of things that I cared about that got in there that I was really happy to see. To work with people like Todd Klutz and Victor Saron, who do a lot of accessibility work. The keyboard accessibility in Yahoo Mail, in my mind, is one of the best web applications out there. And it's great to see, people have reviewed the app and feel the same way. And I love using it because of just how natural it feels. That was something that I was really proud of.
Okay. Well, that's good. Well, I know a lot of people are upset with Google's Gmail's new layout and look, so it might be behoove people to just check out Yahoo Mail and see if the new layout is actually better for them. So, and and also, like, because you were showing me like what you're working on when you're back in the day when you were working on Yahoo Mail, and it looked great. I'm not a big, I guess I use my own domain email, so I don't really do that. But but I also want to talk about what you did your own series with Dan Rubin of what's it called, Creative Sidebar?
Yeah, Sidebar Creative.
Sidebar Creative, and so and how that come about, how that fit in with you know, your freelance work or not, and how that come, how did that, what was Sidebar Creative, and
what was Sidebar Creative? So Sidebar Creative came out of going to conferences. Actually, we had myself, Steve Smith, Brian Veloso, and Dan Rubin were at a conference together. We were all freelancing at the time, and we saw an opportunity to occasionally work on larger projects beyond what any individual one of us could actually work on, and decided, you know what, let's form this little creative group, this little co-op that allowed us to bring larger projects in that we could all work on. And interestingly enough, it didn't quite work out that way. So we created this group. We created the website. You know, we'll work on projects. And we had gotten some projects in that we pulled in that we had worked on collectively. But what we ended up actually doing was working on a lot of our own projects. So we had built some stuff. In fact, when I built a Twitter client way back when, just for fun.
What is that? Was it called Snitter?
It was called Snitter, yeah. Yeah, Snook, nice. Snook's Twitter. So I built Twitter, this Twitter app, and it was great.
What technology was it? Adobe Air, was it?
Or
was
yep. It? Oh, yeah, okay. I used Adobe Air, so it was all HTML, CSS, and JavaScript technologies that I was very familiar with to build this desktop application that could work on, you know, Windows, Mac, and eventually Linux. So from there, switching off to
you're still working on Snitter, right?
No,
that's right. Okay, with all the Twitter stuff going on with like the client and stuff like that, it's like it seems like you need to be, you need to have withstood the early barrage of Twitter, and still like be in their good graces to.
I think if I had stuck with it, I think there was a lot of potential for it. I know at one point I was like within the top 10 Twitter applications. Mm-hmm. I think because there were only 10. Twitter applications at the time. it was fun, right?
Okay.
It was, I liked the fact that people were using it. And I still have the occasional person contact me and say, oh man, I loved Snitter. I'd love to use it again. And it was fun to put together and play with. And, you know, I had these visions of things that I wanted to continue to do with it that I thought would be awesome. Yeah. But I also think like the things that I wanted to do, I can't do now. It's like it's against the rules to do the things that I want to do.
Like what?
So, for example, I had this feature that if you turned it on, it would automatically add embed to tweets. So if somebody said, oh, I had a great day today, it would add embed to the end of it. So I had a great day embed.
the fortune cookie filter?
Is that right? The fortune cookie filter, exactly.
Okay.
Modifying tweets in that way. Wow, I feel like I'm making a lot of noise here. To be able to work on, you know, to be able to modify these tweets, right? That's not something that you could get away with today. One of the things that I wanted to do that I never had a chance to do was to be able to pull in multiple streams from different places. So if you were on Facebook or if you were on Identica, and of course we have app.net now, that you could somehow pull all these things into one stream. But of course you can't do that now either. So just things like that, that I had a lot of fun with, just how I presented tweets even, are things that have evolved such that you have to follow their design standards. They have to be formatted in a specific way. And I think eventually I would have had to give it up anyway.
So you're just like, so you give up on, not give up, but you put Snitter aside. And what other projects did you work on?
So we had that. We also worked on My Mile Marker, which is a little hard to say, but we called it M3 for short. And My Mile Marker was a way to track your mileage. You know, every time you gassed up, so you can see, you know, what kind of fuel mileage am I getting, and be able to track that over time. So that was a project that was mostly spearheaded by Steve Smith, but we all pitched in on design and on development and put that out there. So that was another project that we put out there to share and see what would happen.
Yeah. And then wasn't there Overheard?
Oh, yes, Overheard. That was another fun project. That was a project of mine that, again, I went to the rest of the team and got their assistance on getting that built out. Overheard It was being able to pull stuff from Twitter. So anytime somebody typed in, like, Overheard and some funny saying, I would actually pull those into a single website that you could flip through and just, you know, see what kind of funny things people overheard. Kind of like the Overheard in New York website, but specifically with Twitter and pulling those tweets in.
Cool. And then one thing I absolutely liked that you guys did was the Sidebar Creative Workshop.
Yes. Series.
So I'm not sure what year that was. That seemed like forever now, but it could have been like last year for all I know. But
well, we did a few of them, which was awesome. It was a fun project to work on, and it was an opportunity for us to share our development process. The fact that, you know, you had two really strong designers with Brian and with Dan, and even just, I mean, Steve Smith does some fantastic design work. And, you know, since I was doing some design work, we all had a bit of that design aesthetic. But then we also all had a lot of development background. So Steve on the Ruby side, on the Brian had doing Django development. I did PHP development. So, I mean, we all had this sort of breadth of knowledge that we were able to bring to a full-day workshop. And, so we did a handful of those. I liked that. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I liked it, too. It was, you know, you guys went to Austin, where I'm from. And so I signed up for it. I didn't know what to expect, per se. But it was just great to... you know, I think I was, you know, freelancing at the time, or I was just doing solo stuff. So it was always great to see what, you know, people like you and Brian and Dan and stuff like, and how they code and design and stuff like that. It was like a big, it was probably the biggest shot in the arm in terms of like, of new stuff that I could learn easily. And it wasn't like a big room, you know, it wasn't big, you know, very crowded. You guys probably want a big sold out theater or something, but I don't know. But, but yeah, it was really great because like you could ask questions and so that, and actually just get to the point of like finding what to do. So it wasn't like a beginner conference or workshop. It was actually like it was like intermediate to advanced. And it wasn't advanced. I don't think it was advanced, but it was like intermediate, and like it was really helpful for people who may like be more coder side, if you will, learn about design and or like, you know, or they're hybrid. So I really appreciated that, and I'm really glad you guys did it, even though, you know, you've gone in separate ways now, but yeah, I thought it was really great. And I wish other people could do that too. I mean, it's just, you know, something really short and sweet. But yeah. I just want to tell you how much I appreciated that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate hearing that. It was, and it's interesting how like a lot of the stuff that has come since, at least with a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about, is an extension of that. In fact, the whole sort of book that I wrote that I think we've so far avoided naming up until this point in time. I had actually first mentioned the thoughts of that in the workshop that we did in Austin. So we were doing the workshop and I'm like, you know, I have these ideas that I'm looking to write down. I'm going to start writing about it. And I think the Austin workshop was one of the first, probably the first time that I mentioned it.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad I could help you out of this. Let's play this more. But yeah, so let's finally name the book, which is I have no idea what the name of it. I just know the short handle for it. So it's SMACS, which is SMACSS.
Right? Yes. So the scalable and modular architecture for CSS.
Cool. And there's two things we want to talk about. One is the creation of the book, which yes. we kind of got there. We're like, you've already written a book for a publisher, and now I want to talk about like, you know, how you build it for yourself. And then also the actual concepts that are in the book. So let's just talk with like, you know, writing a book for yourself. Like,
yes.
So we got to the point where like, hey, I've written for 6 months. I got, you know, ever since Christopher told me this awesome idea in Austin, it was really awesome. And I posted it on the web. All right. And what happened next? Like, what was your rationale
to take that? The feedback that I got was very positive. And one of the other great things about it was that I was getting questions, you know, like, what about this? What about that? And it allowed me to go, oh, yes, let me expand on that. And so I continued to write on that. And of course, the more I wrote, the more people had said, you know what, it would be really nice if I had this in an ebook format. I would love to be able to download this and read this on my Kindle.
Do people actually say that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right. if they hadn't, I don't think I would have come up with this idea
right.
to eventually do this.
All right. This is like I can understand people like wanting a book form sometimes, but yeah, okay. So Kindle, so EPUB form, or EPUB or .mobi.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So you got the Mobi format. You've got the EPUB format, PDF. Yeah,
right.
And so as I continued to evolve the writing and get things to a point where I felt like, you know what, this could really come together as a book. Let me pull these chapters together and actually created an ebook format. So I put that together and decided to start selling it. And it was interesting because when I first decided to sell it, most of the content, I would say pretty much every single chapter up until that point, was available for free on the website. And I started selling it and I said, listen, I'm going to continue to write. And from this point on, everything that I'm writing after this will only be for those who have purchased the book. Everything up until now is still free. I'm not like taking it away. You can still go to the site right now, smacks.com, and like 2/3 of the book, absolutely free. A lot of the core ideas behind it, feel free to read it. I think hopefully a lot of people get a lot of value out of that. But I thought, okay, you know what? I'm at this point. I've invested a lot of time, a lot of effort. I learned a ton about creating ebooks. Just how do you build the format? How do you put it all together? And you know, how does that work on the Kindle? How does it work on the iPad? What does the PDF look like? That kind of thing. And was a great process to go through. I absolutely loved it. And it sold really well. I was actually kind of surprised at how well it sold.
Well, also, did you also, oh, sorry, let me say also again, but you built the e-commerce part too?
I did, yeah. At that point, I had, designed the book. Mm-hmm. I ended up getting a gentleman, Kyle Jones, based in Nashville, to do the illustration on the cover, the lumberjack, Jack the Lumberjack, and there's a bit of a story behind that as well. But so he did the illustration, but I did the book design, the cover design, the site design,
all right.
E-commerce integration, everything else.
Okay, you're going to have to tell me the story about the lumberjack.
The lumberjack.
Yeah, the lumberjack story. Okay, what's the story with that?
So Jack the Lumberjack was an idea that I had. Did a little sketch, sent it off to Kyle and said, "Like, listen, I'd love to get a nice illustration of this. And why a lumberjack? Well, one, I thought, hey, you know what? It's a thing. Everybody loves a good mascot, right? You know, some way of identifying with something. But I live here in Ottawa. Ottawa, Canada, actually used to be the lumberjack capital of the world. We were a huge logging town. We had like a little village of lumberjacks, and we still have paper mills. And as a result of that, it was a way of honoring Ottawa, this place that I live right now. And so, yeah, you know, I thought a lumberjack was a great way to do that. Who doesn't love a lumberjack? Lumberjacks are very Canadian. So, yeah, sent it off, got the illustration, and interestingly enough, he actually had a red suit to start off with a red hat. And I thought, you know what, that's maybe a little too Santa. Maybe not quite the right approach. You know, even though he had his like plaid thing, red wasn't the color that I wanted to go for. And so the blue toque, as we call it here in Canada, the blue toque, the blue beanie, as I think you Americans call it, I realized, you know what, blue beanies kind of have a significance when it comes to web design and web development. Our community has that association with web standards, and I thought it was a great way as well to honor web standards by donning him in blue. So that's the background, the story of Jack the Lumberjack.
Okay, cool.
That's a great story.
Oh, and I did not know Ottawa's main export is lumberjacks. That's pretty awesome. So,
there you go.
All right, cool. Awesome. Okay, so basically you're doing like, I think I also talked to you about this too, about the book, we were working on it, was like, you took a lot of pride, I think, you know, that's the feeling I got, it was like, of building everything yourself, like from the e-commerce to like, you know, hiring the illustrator to designing everything. And you know, I think that's awesome that you have the skill set to do that. And, you know, that was that your goal in that? Or was that just, you know, that you like, hey, I ran this book, I want to take it and do as much as I can independently and just, and not like farm it out to like a third party e-commerce.
I don't know. I don't think it was a very, there wasn't like that decision-making point in time where I said, you know what, I will do it all. Instead, it just kind of turned out that way. It just became this like, well, what's the next step? Okay, well, I want to do this and I want to learn about it. I want to learn about how this stuff works. And so I worked through that process in order to do that. So even if there was another company that could have done it for me, I felt like I didn't find that company. I didn't find that service that I could just give everything to and know that what I got back was awesome. That what it was something that I was going to be proud of and wanted to have. So being able to go through that process and really learn, you know, how all the stuff gets made and comes together was just a lot of fun to learn about. It was a way of growing my technical chops in a new area that I hadn't really played around with before.
Awesome. And what would you do differently? If you were to do anything differently?
I think the only real weak spot in this whole thing was the e-commerce setup. And I feel like I'm setting up a plug here, but bear with me for a moment. So the first, I worked on this, and I remember this was like Thanksgiving weekend, U.S. Thanksgiving weekend. I knew I had a long weekend that I wanted to get this stuff done. I had finished it off on Saturday, put it up, but hadn't really told anybody about it yet, and realized that the way I was doing the PayPal integration, because at this point PayPal was the only way I was collecting money, and realizing that I didn't really do it correctly, and that if people didn't click on a particular link on a particular screen, I would never know that they actually bought the book. And like all the automation that I had set up would have completely failed. So like, okay, screw this. I spent another, you know, 12 hours rewriting the PayPal integration so that it was actually done properly, that the notifications would hit my server so that I could set up your account so you could actually log in and access the ebook. And then I announced it. So it was on the Monday on that, right after that long weekend. And okay, like, here's the book. I'm finally done. You can now go and buy it. And I think that the lesson learned there was just, it would have been easier if I had a service just do that for me. Mm-hmm. And that, so there was another inflection point. I want to say probably the following January or February. So I felt really uncomfortable putting all this money into PayPal, reading a lot of stories of people that were having their accounts shut down. And because my ebook was a virtual product, you know, there was really no proof of delivery. And without that proof of delivery, mm-hmm. I was worried that PayPal could shut down my account at any point. So I looked into another payment gateway called Moneris. It was one my bank recommended. I don't know how good they are compared to other ones, but it's one I was familiar with. I had actually worked on some client projects beforehand, so I was, again, familiar with it, but I wasn't going through like all the PCI compliance stuff that people have to worry about. You know, how do I store credit card numbers? I don't want to worry about that. So I put everything through the Moneris hosted solution, but it didn't look pretty. It didn't really feel integrated, but it got the job done, and it worked okay. And interestingly enough, sort of the overlapping of timelines, once I got that integrated, well, I'm now working at Shopify and seeing, okay, you know what, here's a platform that handles Moneris integration. I just, you know, give them my ID and everything is seamless. And it was later on that year that I actually ended up moving my store, part of it, the whole purchase process, onto Shopify. I still have my own website that handles all the account stuff. There's webhooks that communicate each other, but that the actual payment process, I don't have to worry about the security. I don't have to worry about any of that. But I still have all my order management. I still have all my customer management. And all the stuff is integrated because of the API that Shopify offers. So it saved me a lot of headaches. Mm-hmm. And things have been really stable as a result. And I think that, as of all things, know where your expertise lies. And at when I started out, I didn't know where my expertise, I didn't know the limit of what I felt I knew and didn't know. So it was a great experience to go through anyway. Mm-hmm. But I feel a lot better now that everything's on Shopify.
Yeah, cool. Right. And so you got the book out, and I think also we talked about, like, at one point in time, like, you maybe thought about, like, I'm just going to do Smacks for a year, and then I'm going to just, you know, see how it goes. And I think we're on, like, year three or something like that. I'm not really sure.
It's getting close to that. It's just past 2 years since the book was – no, because the book was released in November. So we're coming up onto 2 years.
Oh, coming up 2 years. Okay. So that's awesome. So.
But yeah, and it's like I said, the success of the book has really surprised me. I had a bet with a friend of mine, and I said, you know what, you know, in the first 2 weeks, I'm going to say maybe 50 copies. I'd be happy if I sold 50.
Right.
She said, I think 225 was her number.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, you know what, if it's 225, I'll be ecstatic. I sold over 100 in the first day.
Oh, wow.
And it was just like, oh, this feels good. So, you know, obviously people have enjoyed it, have thought that the stuff that I was talking about was worthwhile to read.
So only 100 people bought your book so far?
Yes, only 100 people.
Oh, man. All right.
That's amazing. I haven't actually counted. I used to be really particular in checking my stats and saying, well, this many people have bought the book so far. Mm-hmm. At this point, I've kind of stopped checking. But I would say probably around 4,000 copies sold.
Oh, wow, that's pretty good. That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome, man. That's and for an independent publisher, that's I mean, you, I don't know, and you get to keep all the royalties and all the stuff like that. So, and it's an ebook, so, you know, I'm just doing the numbers right now. I don't know, but no, I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's just you know, Zelman, he used to do this, and I think in the mid early 2000s, like the independent publisher, you know, content is awesome and king, and so just to be able to do that, I think is just speaks greatly of the nature of the web, you know, and that's what it is. But also just to, you know, put something out there and have it respected and people want to buy it. So it's pretty, pretty awesome. So, yeah. Okay. Well, like we've talked about, like, the building of it a little bit. I could talk all day about this stuff because I love this part. But let's talk about the concepts of the book of Smacks.
Certainly.
And, yeah. So, if you don't mind, I know you've probably talked about this like a million times all over the place. What are the core concepts of Smacks?
It's so the core concept of Smacks was really about the categorization. That was, to me, when I started out, it was the categorization of the type of CSS that we were writing. Why are we writing a particular rule and really trying to figure out how that fits into the entire ecosystem of what we're building. Because I think traditionally, certainly the way I was developing it and the way I was seeing other people develop it was, I build a page, right? I'm going to build my homepage. I'm going to do everything I need to make this homepage look great. And now I'm going to work on the inside page. And I'm going to write all the CSS for anything that's different than the homepage. And when you're working on a blog and you've only got two templates, that works great. But when you're working on an application that has dozens and dozens of controls that, you know, are mixed and matched in different ways on different screens, that approach becomes very difficult to work with. And so the stuff that came out of Yahoo was this recognition of this modularity that we needed. So, okay, what are we writing and why are we writing it? And so those categories were, you know, we have our base styles, we have our layout styles, then we have like the individual sort of content pieces that I call modules. Then we have states, you know, these layouts and modules can exist in different states. How do we represent those and the CSS that we're writing for those? And then lastly was themes. You know, we have something on the screen that needs to change and react visually to users. So, you know, a user wants something to look pink instead of blue. How do we represent that differently? And so those were the five categories. And from there, I think unexpectedly, at least to me, was this idea of, okay, well, now that you've categorized things, how do you name things in a way that clarifies that categorization? And then the naming convention became just as, if not more important than everything else, in that, okay, well, how we name things is going to make things instantly clear as to how things are associated, what they belong to. And then there was a number of other things that kind of branch off that, which, of course, is really the rest of the book.
For me, it's I remember trying to teach myself a lot of responsive web design or learn some sort of, you know, foundations or any of the I'm forgetting all of my words today, too. Any of the like CSS 1140 or any of those frameworks or anything like that, and seeing that sort of structure and thinking, oh, that's brilliant. And then I just started picking that up and then came across your book and I was like, oh, that's where it came from. That makes sense. And then I started talking to my students about it because they got really interested in the idea of, well, how should stuff be ordered? Is there a particular way? And they see the value in it at their stage where they're still early into coding. And if they start right, they end up in a really good place. So it's really helpful.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that, and what I'm talking about with SMAX and what I've written in the book isn't, I don't think it's revolutionary. In fact, a lot of what I wrote was an amalgamation of a lot of ideas that I have been seeing other people talk about. So in a lot of ways, I don't feel like I've broken down any walls or broken any barriers in how we develop things, but just I think maybe codified an approach that was a little bit different than the stuff that I was working on before. So, you know, I had seen, of course, Nicole Sullivan with object-oriented CSS that, you know, a lot of people were already familiar with. A lot of those similar concepts were stuff that I was applying. Stuff that Jeremy Keith, Natalie Down, Gina Bolton, a lot of them were already talking about CSS architecture and the way, you know, they sort of break things down into these smaller chunks, this very atomic level of thinking. And now we're seeing a lot more around that. You know, we see Nicholas Gallagher and the way he approaches things. There's a framework out of Russia called BEM, stands for Block Element Modifier, that, again, is very similar. Talks about naming convention, talks about the sort of separation of these components. Harry, CSS Wizardry is his Twitter handle. Harry talks a lot about CSS architecture and the stuff that he's doing. And everybody's sort of now, I think, on this very similar wavelength. And so we're talking about this at the CSS architecture level. We're also now starting to see a lot of people talk about this more at a higher design level. So we look at Brad Frost, for example, talking about this atomic design approach. We have the folks at Paravel have a wonderful article talking about the work that they did for Microsoft on responsive deliverables, where we had these individual components that we're dealing with. So this idea that we're not looking at things necessarily as an entire page, but as this framework of design components that people interact with. And SMAX is just really one way of looking at it. And it's not a library. It's just, how can you look at this entire ecosystem of web development and how can you fit it into this approach that makes sense?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, how I think you guys asked this on the online version of the workshop, just like, how does it fit in with OOCSS that Nicole's been doing? And I'm not sure what the answer was. I forgot what the answer was, actually. It just feels like it's just a flavor of it and they can be utilized or
what? I think that the important thing with the book is it's a reflection of who I am as a web developer, and that is I will never take anything wholesale. So I don't expect anybody to take SMAX wholesale. I'm hoping that they take it and see an approach to something, you know, similar extension to what we did with Sidebar Creative, in the sense that, okay, here is the way we're developing it. Maybe you can pick something from that works for you, and maybe you can tell me something that works for you. And so with OOCSS, there are a lot of similarities in that we're trying to modularize things, break things down into smaller components that we can pull together. I think where things differ a little bit is how we pull those pieces together. And so I've talked to a few people that, you know, sort of fall more under the OOCSS approach. Mm-hmm. And the way they combine things, I think, is a little bit different than the way I combine things in SMAX. But at the end of the day, there's so many similarities that I don't really see them as being dramatically different.
Right. Yeah. I think it's definitely the idea of like, don't take anything wholesale and as a, as a way of building things. I think that's just not very good web development ethic, to do it. And also, I think just something like SMAX or OOCSS, and then you need to have something like SAS, I think, or less, just to make things so much easier to work on and to build things so much quicker and easier. So for your team, I guess for Shopify, do you guys use SMAX all the time, or what's
it? Well, when I came on board, it was a little bit different than with Yahoo. So Yahoo, it was, you know, greenfield. We started off from scratch, building up everything from nothing. And that is a very freeing environment to create in. When I started at Shopify, they already had an existing code base. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like I could just come in and say, okay, we're going to tear all this down. We're going to get rid of it. We're going to start everything from scratch. That wasn't really a practical approach. So then it became, okay, well, how do we look at the concepts and evolve the project so that it's heading in that direction, which I think is important, right? Every project is an evolution. I think that any project that I've worked on has been a little bit different at the end than it has been at the beginning in how I approach development.
Right.
So much so that when I see code from the beginning of the project, I go, ooh, why did I do it that way?
Right. Well, that's one thing I'm kind of interested in too, is like, what steps are you taking? Because I'm actually researching, trying to find solutions and tell people, like, if they have a legacy website and they want it responsive, what steps do they need to take? And they can't change the underlying code base, right? Like, how do we work to make that more responsive? Because it would be awesome, like you did at Yahoo, just like, okay, we're just going to just start fresh and all that. So, yes. But you can't really do it. So what steps did you take to move?
The steps that we took were to take it one step at a time. The ability to refactor a component and then separate that out into its own module. So the first one that I ended up working on was buttons. Okay, let's go through, find any declaration of buttons in this project and isolated into its own module. And you know, pull all the dependencies so that it could stand alone. It does mean that, yes, I am doing a refactor. It does mean that I'm rewriting stuff that had already been written. A few things might break. Let me fix those. But I am working on one problem area. I'm not trying to rewrite everything on the website. I'm just working on one individual component. So to take that stuff and migrate it over into its own thing, and then be like, okay, you know what? This piece is done for now. I'm going to commit this, and I've started off. Our project now has one module, a button, and then just continuing to evolve from there. So, okay, this is our, you know, our table design. Let's move that into its own thing. This is our drop-down menus. Let's move that into its own thing. And then each new component that we built that didn't exist yet, we would start off in a modular approach. And that modularity just continues to grow. So we get more and more components. And the sort of behemoth of the original CSS gets smaller and smaller.
Yeah, so basically, like, so good idea. Yeah, just one step at a time, like I said.
Exactly.
I guess, like, where do you see Smacks going from here? I mean, we already talked about how you thought it would be 1 year. We're, like, approaching 2 years. And do you – I know I saw an interview where you researched – well, the same interview was, like, kind of cool. There's 2 points. One point was Smacks is being adopted by Drupal.
Yes.
That is so, so cool. That's awesome, dude. That's crazy cool. Drupal is used by, like, how many millions of people, but millions of websites, but that's just awesome thing to have happen. So kudos, man. That's awesome.
Thank you.
And the other thing was that you thought about doing a, the actual idea was proposed, I'm not sure I actually thought about doing it, but fleshing out the book with like a second edition that looks at case studies or maybe a full fleshed out website and doing that. Is that still a potential down the road, or are you working on that? Or
yeah, it's definitely a potential. I haven't started working on it, mostly because a lot of my time over the last 6 months, I kind of overworked myself a little bit with there's more to two things that I ended up overwhelming myself with. One was work. Mm-hmm. At Shopify, just the stuff that I was working on, you know, trying to rebuild and launch a new product, was a lot of work. And then doing a lot of conference speaking. I had attended and spoke at a number of conferences over the course of a few months, doing workshops. And then actually also ended up helping Nicole Sullivan work on the CSS conf. That went on in Florida. So to, you know, help pull off a conference, to do all the public speaking, to do the workshops, to do my day job, to, you know, I still have two kids, you know. So I had overwhelmed myself with all of that, that I didn't really have an opportunity to really continue to foster Smacks in with the content and stuff that I wanted. However, amazingly, in all of this, two people stepped up and offered to do translations for the book, which has been, you know, totally awesome. So I now have a French version for Smacks, and I have a Japanese version for Smacks. So, you know, new audiences, which is great. So
that's pretty awesome. Yeah, I just doing research. I was like, "Oh, there's a Japanese version of this. That's amazing. It's awesome." And for an independent publisher, that's pretty awesome to do that. It's not impossible, but I think just, you know, like with what you have is what you've done is awesome with that. So cool. So yeah, I can definitely see like you being stretched then, because I mean you did the online workshops through our Environments for Humans. That was pretty awesome.
Yep.
Had a good time with that, and then you're coming to CSS.conf in October to the workshop.
Yes.
So you've been.
And CSS DevConf will be my last workshop of this year. Mm-hmm. So I, again, with all that sort of work, I'm starting to scale back a little bit as far as public speaking and the workshops. So I've got two more workshops to finish off the year, the one at CSS DevConf in Colorado, and another in coordination with Smashing they have the Smashing Workshop, so I'll be doing a workshop in Berlin at the beginning of October. So that is all I have for this year.
That's awesome.
I was wondering, kind of going back to when the book was first launched, and I know you said you weren't really looking at the stats as much anymore, but I did come across the gender post.
Yes.
I was wondering if you've seen a change in those numbers from the 95% purchases came from men and 5.5 roughly came from women.
I haven't followed up on that stat. I don't know if it's actually really changed that much. It's also a little bit harder now I would have to look at just the English market in the sense that a lot of the Japanese names, I can't tell if they're male or female. I feel like things haven't really changed that much, but it would be interesting. I mean, that's all hypothetical. I would actually have to take a look at the stats and go through and scour and kind of guess at, you know, which names are male gendered and which ones are female gendered and kind of make some assumptions on that. But I know certainly for the workshops that I've done, that the mix, it's not a 5% mix. I know when I did the one in Portland, I think it was about 25% women. So definitely a higher percentage of involvement, which, I mean, I would love to see a more balanced representation.
Good question. Good. We always ask at the end, like, how can people find you on the lines, on the social medias, stuff like that?
they can certainly find my website, in which I post very randomly and sporadically now. I think I've only had one post this year. Snook.ca is my blog. Of course, they can check out the book at smacks.com, smacss.com, and on the Twitter at snookca. Interestingly enough, at Snook is a web developer as well, but not me. At
yes,
snookca.
Yes, I found that out just recently too.
and not at Snook I, S-N-O-O-K-I. I'm not at Snooky. That is somebody else.
Okay.
Snook CA, they can find me.
Cool.
She's verified on Twitter. Wow.
I need to get verified, apparently.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being part of the show, and I'll talk to you soon. And
awesome.
See you at DevCon. All right. Talk later.
Thank you very much. A lot of fun.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.